Hello, I'm Philip Stoughton. Welcome to EMS at Sea Level, from my home to yours. I am joined today by two executives from Benchmark to explore the topic of US versus Mexico in terms of manufacturing location. We've seen a lot of trends pushing change in the manufacturing geography that brands look to, but also that EMS companies look to in their own mix. Let's start with a couple of introductions. Jennifer, perhaps if we can start with you, just give me a little bit of a background from yourself and what you currently do at Benchmark.
Sure. So my name is Jennifer McAlpin. I've been with Benchmark about 4 years. I'm the product marketing manager covering kind of strategy for all of our sectors, looking to see, you know, what challenges our customers facing and how can we help them meet those.
Okay. And Pete?
Yes, Pete Stanius. I've been at Benchmark for about 5 years now. I've been in the EMS industry for roughly 30. I'm currently the vice president of our, what we call our America South, which consists of our Phoenix and Mexico EMS facilities.
Okay. So I just really wanted to start with a trend I've been noticing more and more over the last 12 months, but I think it kind of started way back when we had the trade war between China and the US under Trump, and then, you know, we got into the pandemic, component shortages. There's a desire to rethink supply chains a little bit, and some of that is a desire to go to shorter supply chains. I see that as having some benefits for sustainability as well as security and a whole bunch of other things. Jennifer, perhaps if I can start with you, what kind of dynamic are you seeing in terms of the demand from customers?
So we started seeing, I think you're right, and it's definitely ramped up in the past 2 years where we're having more customers inquiring about getting closer to their customer base or maybe having a multi-geography strategy, perhaps if they're addressing customers in the US and Europe. But I'm finding that more and more the geography is part of the initial conversation about where they want to be. And it's not straight to where can we find the lowest labor costs. There's more and more considerations that are coming into play, whether it be, you know, if there's a design that's not 100% stable, they know they're going to iterate, they want to be closer to the engineering team in the US or Mexico, or just thinking about how much time something's going to spend as sea freight if it's shipped from further away.
Yeah, so it becomes proximity to design, proximity to them as a brand, proximity to their consumer, all those things are important. And there seems to be an element of desire to decouple with China a little bit. Are you seeing that as well?
There is for a number of reasons. There's a lot of high quality manufacturing in China. It's not a get rid of China, but there can be, depending on your product, depending on what your goals are, reasons to look for places other than China. So Benchmark also does have sites in other parts of Asia. And I think in every customer case, we want to look at their overall goals and see where we can best meet those needs. So it's not a one size fits all.
No, absolutely not. And I completely agree with you. I think China's supply chain and manufacturing infrastructure is incredibly impressive. And much as they may have kicked the door open with low-cost labor, they've certainly kept it open with kind of quality and infrastructure and logistics and all those good things. Pete, when you look at selecting a manufacturing geography from Benchmark's point of view, but also on behalf of your customers, What are the key factors that you're considering, and have those factors changed over the last few years?
They have changed. Some things haven't changed. Some things stay the same. You know, what are the quality ratings or the you know, the requirements of the particular product, and you know, what facilities do we have that match those particular needs, and that hasn't changed. But some things have changed. We're certainly seeing, maybe to couple on to what Jennifer was saying, we're certainly seeing a trend where customers aren't necessarily leaving Asia, but more supplanting their Asia manufacturing with also nearshoring And typically when they're doing that, they're going to need lower costs than the United States, and Mexico obviously is a very attractive option for them. And so, you know, we're really kind of seeing a lot of partnership between our Mexico sites with our Asia sites in terms of manufacturing sometimes the same product, sometimes very similar products, but maybe just different versions of it. So, and that is somewhat new. It, you know, back a few years ago when everybody was heading to Asia, it was almost a complete pullout. But here, in terms of those companies that are over there, I'm seeing more of a partnership between the two sites. Now, in terms of new products, we have both a border town facility and we have a facility, in central Mexico. And so some of the things that we have to take a look at are, what is the transit time coming out? What are the, what is the size of it, weight of it? So when we consider freight, do they need to be closer to the border? Do they need to be central? But we're certainly seeing tremendous growth at both sites.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you do have the, I think it's two sites in Tijuana, and you have the other site in Guadalajara. And also, I'm fascinated by what you were saying about the fact that when people were going to Asia, it was a kind of, this is it, we're all going that way trend. And now people are perhaps bringing some business back. It's a little bit more pragmatic. It feels like the industry has grown up and being a bit more sensible this time around. I like to think we learn, but I'm not always convinced. Just quickly, this interview was sparked by a blog you wrote. One of the things that has changed recently is the change from the NAFTA agreement to the USMCA agreement. Has that had much impact? Is that been pretty much?
I don't believe that's really had much of an impact on us at all. We had an agreement before, we have a current one. I don't know that I've seen any change in, any sort of our ability to service or the logistics of getting things across the border. Mm-hmm. That's been a fairly smooth transition, I believe, because of all of the efforts on the supply chain side before the pandemic and the supply chain shortage, a buyer would go out and they'd place orders and for the most part, manage the order, maybe do a little bit of expediting, maybe do a little bit of, PO management, but for the most part, that was it. But now it's, placing POs and then expediting. And of course, with the inflationary costs of components going up, it's PO management and it's and then tracking the orders, trying to get them across the border or even into a port. We've had to redirect boats to other ports because of backlogs at ports. Mm-hmm. And so it's the work effort on the supply chain has been incredible. And in towns like Guadalajara, where there's a lot of demand for this function, we've really seen, the cost of this labor increase. So certainly it's still, a very competitive market to build product, but certainly that's been probably, the availability of labor and dealing with the increasing costs have really been one of the more challenging things to deal with this last year, on top of course, the supply chain challenges.
Yeah, I mean, the supply chain thing's been huge, and that's kind of the elephant in the room that you can't avoid, isn't it?
Everybody's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So how much is the labor gap between the US and Mexico narrowing? And is that set against a backdrop where the labor content is actually going down because there's more and more automation?
There is more automation, and that is something that we work with more and more customers on. Several years ago it was kind of a niche thing, but now it's many, many new products require automation. And so we actually have a team, an automation team that comes in and works specifically on a design to put in that automation. And so, and honestly, when you create an automated solution, it's the cost of depreciation of the asset is your biggest expense more than labor. Mm-hmm. And so you now have a more transferable product at that time when you do have the automation in. But the savings in Mexico are still substantial over the U.S., but the rate at which the labor is increasing there, certainly, the arbitrage is shrinking, but it's still very, very competitive relative to the U.S.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it has been steady for maybe the previous decade or more when you look at it back from, I guess, around about 2000 when US companies really started to build out their capacity in Mexico. It's been fairly flat and consistent, and the exchange rate's been relatively kind at the same time. So it's made it quite competitive. Jennifer, I just really wanted to touch again on the selection process as the customers see it. How much of that is driven by sentiment? I have a sense that kind of post-COVID, the US saw, and I guess this would be reflected in US OEMs rather than non-US OEMs, but the US saw manufacturing as an opportunity to get people back to work, to push the economy forward. We're now in a position where we've got inflationary pressure and we don't have much in the way of unemployment. So that was maybe a concern that was unfounded. But how much is sentiment? How much are brands saying, hey, you know, we need to be made in the US, or we need to be made in the Americas? How much does that impact their decision?
I think we do have customers asking for that, absolutely. It depends a little bit on who they're targeting as customers, whether their customers value that made in the US or even, you know, made in North America, I think does still have very positive brand value in a marketing perspective. And I think the other thing that we started seeing about a year ago, the US government too has increased its preference for US made goods and some changes that have come with the Buy American Act, some of the funding that was passed by Congress last year included expansion of what was covered, and some of the definitions of when Buy America applies, you know, have been updated to apply to more goods. And we're hearing customers say, okay, so maybe the US government is one of my end markets. Maybe they're not my only end market, but should I consider manufacturing in the US for all of my products to just kind of simplify things and give me that advantage with Buy American? So there's both, I think it all comes down to what the end user thinks. And so whether that be the US government or another group, I think our customers at the OEMs are seeing different reasons why they may want to choose North American manufacturing.
Yeah. Pete, when they come with that question of should I be moving all of my business to the Americas or should I be distributed around the world, what's your answer? When I look at a company that's maybe, you know, got a, I don't know, say $75 million spend, then having it in multiple sites makes sense. If I've got a $2 million spend, maybe having it in multiple sites makes it very, very much more expensive. How do you make that decision, or how do you help them make a good decision?
Yeah, you're spot on in exactly what you said. You know, with a large spend, you can afford to build that product very close to your customer in multiple facilities. And certainly we have customers that do that. But with a lower spend now, you're not absorbing your overhead of the fixed costs of the team, and you just can't, you know, you just don't have that flexibility. So in that particular case, it really comes down to where is their end market? If their end market truly is global, where is their main end market? Yeah, because you can really only pick one at that point. And if it's in the U.S. as an example, if that's their main market, then we have to determine the price sensitivity of the particular product, and then the buy requirements. And then certainly, if it's a highly competitive bid and it is not required to be built in the U.S., you know, then likely Mexico would be the solution that we would pick. And you know, we've certainly seen a lot of people going down that road on that decision across this entire industry.
Yeah. And then I guess the other factor that comes into that is, okay, well, if we're manufacturing in a particular geography and there's a disruption in that geography, we've got a single geography, how quickly can you shift it? Is that a question of automation, of having a digital thread throughout the process? Do you have like a, you know, an emergency preparedness plan where you can say, okay, well, you know, there's been a COVID outbreak in Mexico, there's a shutdown in Guadalajara or whatever, we've got to shift that business? How easy is
that? Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, every facility at Benchmark has an emergency plan that does just that. You know, what happens if the plant gets shut down for power, you know, natural disaster, COVID, whatever have you, and then it redirects where the products will go. And you know, so there for every single customer, we do have those types of emergency plans. You know, and in our case, you know, we have these sister sites in Mexico. And one thing across Benchmark as well is that we have common processes, common procedures. And so we can lift and shift a little bit better than perhaps, you know, some others may be able to. But we also not only just utilize our sister plant in the case of Mexico, we also can come back to Phoenix or Minnesota or some of our other sites here in the United States. And so it's, but having that plan is critical. You know, it's a while back, you know, we had a issue in our Thailand plant with the flooding and we learned a lot from that. And we were able to lift and shift production for that facility all over the world, quite honestly. And from that, we learned a lot at Benchmark about, you know, how to maybe more, you know, manage our risk and how to, you know, disaster recovery plans, you know, what to put in them and how to execute them and how to launch them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think design for disruption is becoming a key factor, whether it's designing the product or designing the supply chain. And we've gone from one disruption to another, and I don't expect that to change. So I think we need to plan for that. Pete, when you're looking at these trends from your customers, you're looking at the different balances and trends that you're seeing in the different regions. Are you then inputting into Benchmark's strategy for future site development? I look at your footprint and I actually really like your footprint because your Asia footprint has a strong Thailand presence, a Malaysian presence, you know, some great Pac Rim regions to manufacture in, as well as the China footprint. I don't think there are many companies of your scale that would have 12 facilities in the US. So that's super impressive in itself. And, you know, you're in one of my favorite towns in Mexico, Guadalajara. So that's all good. It looks like a good footprint, but what do you think about as you plan forward?
Yeah, thank you for that. I appreciate that. We are building a new facility in Guadalajara and so we're expanding our capabilities there, and it'll be state-of-the-art new facility there. And we're expanding our manufacturing footprint within our Tijuana facility as well. So certainly we're seeing the growth there. But one thing that, you know, Benchmark did, I've worked at a couple different EMS companies, and one thing I saw them doing is closing down a lot of U.S. sites. And Benchmark still has a real solid, as you mentioned, footprint within the U.S. And certainly with this trend, we're certainly poised to take advantage of the movement back to the U.S. So we have this installed structure of experienced and very capable plants here in the U.S. And so, yeah, I agree with you. I think we kept our foundations where it made sense, and we've certainly made some strategic growth. I know we've been expanding here in the Phoenix area, where our headquarters are located in Tempe, and we're actually expanding into a facility nearby, just down the road, and the facility that the EMS facility that I lead, just down the road from the airport, we're growing considerably there too, and that's all through, you know, what we're seeing as this trend, and also through some of the increased capabilities that we're offering our customers around these different sites.
Yeah. And they want to get in. They want to get in and work with you on design, because it's not just they're not just showing up with a box of parts and asking you to put them on a PCB anymore. It's much more complex than that. So the relationship is a much tighter partnership.
That's for sure. Especially the supply chain really expounded upon that, right? They needed our engineering skills to redesign in parts that were maybe more available. And when I say more available, I use it a little loosely. It's not back in the day when we could get it tomorrow, but it's better than 52 weeks or 78 weeks. And so we're seeing a lot of partnership between our customers and our engineering teams and our manufacturing teams and coming up with creative solutions and redesigns. And you know, there's some customers for which we have four different versions that we drive in our MRP, and we build whatever one that we have the parts, and we're able to be flexible and jump it around in order to continue to provide them with product. And you know, that's not unique. This has kind of become the model that we work with many of our customers, just to continue to be able to output product while we, you know, struggle through the supply chain globally.
Yeah. Last question for you, Jennifer. Voice of customer is something that's absolutely essential and obviously something you listen to. Mm-hmm. How important is it that you're listening to what they're thinking in terms of trends and you're connecting that to the operations team and making sure everybody's aware that this is how the customers and this is how our potential customers are thinking?
Yeah, I love that question because that's the best part of my job, right? I get to go spend time with customers and actually when I take notes, the first thing I write down is the questions they ask because I want to know what's on their mind, what they're still trying to solve. And I'm lucky that Benchmark, because we do have these, I'm in Phoenix based too. And in Phoenix, we have two soon to be three sites plus an engineering team. I can go join customer meetings on a pretty regular basis. And that is so helpful. So I'm always get to reach out to, Pete's team, of course, is always in contact with customers too, but we make sure that we share what we're hearing. And I think it is really helpful to even have those conversations, not just of, hey, what's your next product launch, but where are you going after that? Mm. And especially, we have in our US sites that have the engineering experience, we also have, some of the more advanced capabilities and things like microelectronics where, look, we're going to work with you to iterate. What are you going to need to make the next big thing work? So,
Yeah, no, it plays very much to what I've been writing about in both Forbes and Fast Company recently, which is this trend from electronic manufacturing services to electronic manufacturing partnerships. I'm trying to rebrand the industry as EMP rather than EMS because I just feel service doesn't cover it. We're way more than that. We really are the manufacturing partner, and if OEMs see that and they rely on that and they understand that deserves perhaps a little bit of a slightly wider margin than we're used to, and there's some more value add in there, I think that's a good thing for them as well, because they'll end up with better, more reliable partners. So that's great.
I think that will be the trend. That will be the trend as we go forward. It'll turn into an expectation as opposed to just a nice to have.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And some of the disruptions have driven that. The EMS industry has really had to step up during the pandemic to support its customers. The component shortages have put huge stress on the relationship with brands, because you're constantly going back to brands and saying, hey, this thing doesn't cost what it used to. It's not available. We've been rescheduled to this. And by the way, we might be calling you again because the reschedules we've been given by our component suppliers aren't as reliable as they should be. So I think it's changing the relationship, but it's also showing the value in the relationship. You kind of see the value in relationships when there's a bit of stress. So.
Yeah, oddly, I was just going to go there, actually. Oddly, they've almost been strengthened through the conversations that we have to have. And it's not people sitting on opposite sides of the table. We're joining together to figure out how do we solve this problem. And they're tough decisions because you're right. The amount of increases of these costs of components and the price increases due to the labor costs that we've had to pass on has been a real challenge in the relationship. Yet in some ways it's also strengthened it because of the conversations that we have to have to sit together and solve problems. And so that part has been interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, and the extra layer on top of that is, in many cases, they've had to place longer orders, as you have with your component suppliers. So that's you're creating additional stickiness there. So I think that's good for the industry. Before we wrap up, I wanted to thank you guys for all the blogs you produce. I read something on Benchmark just about every week, and it's always interesting. So thank you for that. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to talking to you again both soon. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you very much.